Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
We have people being deployed three, four, five times, being sent to Iraq, then Afghanistan, then back to Iraq.
There are 4 months left. They could attack Iran. There are indications that they are still hoping to do so.
Dar Jamail joins us for an update on Iraq. And then David Swanson of Democrats.com talks about the new push to impeach George Bush, why it's popular, and how it could influence the election. First, the BBC's Newsnight just showed several clips of interviews with U.S. soldiers serving in Iraq. Here's specialist Holly.
A person can be loyal to his country without being loyal to the people who run his country. I have faith in my chain of command and my leaders, but basically, I think we're in a stupid, pointless war because a lot of politicians either A, can't admit that they were wrong, or B, are making a lot of money off of this war.
The mainstream press has been barely mentioning U.S. military casualties in Iraq. The website globalsecurity.org notes 4 casualties thus far in September. Last month, 22 U.S. soldiers were killed. The Iraqi government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is no longer inclined to remain aligned with U.S. interest in the region, according to Michael Schwartz, author of War Without End, The Iraq War in Context. He wrote in Tom Graham that the Bush administration is, quote, likely to wrest actual defeat from the jaws of self-proclaimed victory. And the Iraqi government has been targeting members of the Sunni Awakening. Their cooperation agreement with the U.S. is credited with a slowdown in violence and the success of the much-touted surge. Journalist Dar Jamail has been following recent events, and he joins us with an update. Dar Jamail, welcome.
Thanks, Dory. Good to be with you.
As you watch the press, do you get the sense that we're seeing yet another version of the big lie that we've seen time and time again, and I mean countless times, really, that there's been this kind of reinvention of the tale of success in Iraq? What is the version we're seeing now compared to what you know about events in Iraq today?
You really spoke the truth of what this is, Dory. It's another round of, well, we've turned another corner. We have success now. Things are getting better. As I've spoken to you either from here in the U.S. or my times in Iraq as far back as 2003, how many of these have we seen, Dory? It's almost hard to keep track how often we've seen this type of thing. And the current version is basically just another spin on the same type of propaganda tactic where the Bush administration and even many in the Obama camp are talking about the success of the surge and that things are better in Iraq, where I would argue that politically right now on the ground in Iraq, things are more fragmented and dangerous than ever before. Simply using the number of U.S. troops being killed as a measure to judge success is kind of an elementary mistake that so many people are making, because that's not an accurate judge. The stated goal of the surge was to create a better security environment to enable reconciliation within the government, and we've had neither of those things, where Baghdad's basically been divided into Sunni and Shia neighborhoods. It's at a temporary stalemate right now. I think violence will kick off again in a matter of less than 6 months from now. And the main thing being that there's no political reconciliation. In fact, the government's more fragmented than ever. We have the U.S. now openly saying that we're going to disband the Awakening groups. That's 100,000-strong Sunni militia. And the government reluctantly absorbing some of them into the security apparatus. This is a Shia-dominated government. And at the same time, are also openly stating we're not going to absorb all of them, and while simultaneously targeting and kidnapping and killing many Sawa leaders around Baghdad, around Diyala province, and even in some places in Anbar province. So we have the brewings of another massive civil war, as these politics kind of will translate eventually into violence on the ground, and that's not even talking about the issue of Kirkuk.
Let's listen to George Bush commenting on the withdrawal of 8,000 U.S. soldiers from Iraq and then the deployment of more troops for Afghanistan.
November Marine Battalion that was scheduled to deploy to Iraq will instead deploy to Afghanistan. It will be followed in January by an Army Combat Brigade. The mission of these forces will be to work with the Afghan forces to provide security for the Afghan people, protect Afghanistan's infrastructure and democratic institutions, and help ensure access to services like education and health care. They will show the citizens of Afghanistan that the government and its partners will stand with them in the battle against the Taliban and the extremists.
Doesn't it sound familiar? I mean, trying to win over local leaders, that's what's planned for Afghanistan. But doesn't it carry the same risk that these alliances just appear to work one minute, fall apart the next, and it all just goes on for a very long time?
Well, one thing the Bush administration has been successful at in Iraq is playing different political and religious groups off against one another. And overall, they've been pretty successful at that. That's why we have, you know, on one hand, Talibani coming to the White House and meeting with officials in the administration. And then on the other hand, we have Maliki, who's far more closely allied with Tehran than ever before. The U.S. has lost control of one of their key puppets in Iraq. So that's why you have now, to kind of counterbalance that, Talibani being invited to Washington. But one thing that we need to pay attention to, that, you know, the talk of troops and removing some from Iraq, drawing them down, you know, as though this is some sign of success. This is basically just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, because the reality is, even if they did withdraw the number of troops that they were initially talking about, 8,000, which they're not going to withdraw that number, Bush has already said he's leaving it up to people to decide in February based on conditions on the ground, if that will still be possible. So he's effectively punted. He'll be out of office for a month by that time. And it's the same old tired rhetoric of, well, we'll leave it to the general to decide based on the situation on the ground at that time. So this is completely empty rhetoric. But even if they did withdraw 8,000 troops, as they said, we're still looking at a number of troops in Iraq higher than pre-surge levels. So, again, how does that fit into their definition of success? It was an escalation. They might take out a few thousand, but we're still going to be left with a higher number of troops in Iraq than we did before the surge even began.
I remember U.S. soldiers telling the press they signed up to go to Iraq, volunteered, after 9/11, you know, hoping they could make America safer. Here we are now, 7 years later. What is your finding now as you talk with U.S. soldiers and contemplate this yourself?
Well, morale is at an all-time low. We saw just in this last week, even the U.S. Army came out with a report that has shown this year they are on track to set yet another record for suicides of U.S. troops serving in Iraq. And I wouldn't expect that trend to change between now and the end of the year. I've been interviewing dozens and dozens of veterans, both active duty and people who have been discharged from the military, who have served in Iraq. And it's really incredible the level of dissent that's going on and the extent to which the U.S. military is going to try to keep this out of the media and keep people quiet. They're giving people promotions, people who've been speaking out, they're giving them promotions to try to shut them up. They're transferring them from one unit to another. Other times they're threatening courts martials to soldiers who are speaking out. But what I'm finding is that there's rampant use of what is referred to as search and avoid missions by soldiers, where they go out and literally fake patrols and sit in fields or sit in Iraqi houses rather than drive around, as they say, waiting to get blown up by roadside bombs. This is rampant all across Iraq, wherever U.S. soldiers are in operations and at bases there. Another thing is there's a very widespread instances of units that are refusing orders. And this is, of course, aside from a few instances where this has made the news and a few instances of outright mutinies, we have really rampant kind of under the table ongoing instances of different units that are being sent out, given orders to go out back out on missions where they're being attacked regularly, and instead of following those orders, literally just not gearing up when the time comes to go out. And we're not hearing about this, but I'm talking with dozens of soldiers reporting on the same things, that this has been going on all around Iraq from almost the very beginning of the occupation, different years of the occupation, different locations, all of these soldiers saying the same thing. And it all adds up to what we have all been hearing with all of these generals that come out and retire from time to time, and talking about the military being stretched thin. We can't continue both of these occupations. We don't have enough people. People are being redeployed over and over and over, as opposed to in Vietnam, they were only forced to serve one tour and then given a choice whether or not they would go back. Well, soldiers now don't have that option. We have people being deployed three, four, five times, being sent to Iraq, then Afghanistan, then back to Iraq, And at the end of the day, as we're well into the sixth year of the occupation now, the military is completely stretched thin. It is broken. And both of these occupations would be completely untenable if it weren't for the fact that there's now more private contractors in Iraq than there are members of the U.S. military.
Dar, thanks a lot for this report.
Thank you, Dory.
The U.S. military seems to be positioning itself to take action in Iran and Eastern Europe, too. Next time, we'll hear from Michael T. Clare of Hampshire College, author of the book Blood and Oil, and other books on energy and security. We'll also hear again from Francis A. Boyle, an international law expert who has suggested a legal action might prevent the U.S. or Israel from threatening to attack Iran. The BBC is reporting that Iran lodged a formal protest with the U.N., after Israeli Minister Rafi Itan, a former Nazi hunter, said his country could kidnap Iran's president over threats he has made against Israel. Iran's UN ambassador has called the remark outrageous and vicious and is calling on the UN Security Council to take action. David Swanson of Democrats.com and AfterDowningStreet.org joins us next to discuss a press conference in Washington, D.C., where Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich talked about growing interest in impeaching George Bush. Here's attorney Jonathan Turley on MSNBC with Keith Olbermann speaking about the articles of impeachment drafted by Kucinich.
What's really disturbing for many of us is that it takes a real effort for Democrats to walk from the floor to their offices and not trip over crimes. I mean, they are all over the record, from destruction of evidence to illegal surveillance to unlawful torture programs. They're all over the place. And what's amazing is that the president is hiding in plain view. He hasn't really denied the elements of these offenses. So all that is lacking is political will.
David Swanson, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What's the latest on impeachment, and why is Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich holding a press conference in Washington now?
Well, the congressman is going to talk about a stack of petitions and signatures he's delivering today to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, demanding that impeachment proceedings begin. This is not a new demand, but it is one that he is pushing stronger. He is also going to announce the proposal that he's going to be introducing in the Congress to establish a National Reconciliation Commission with the power of subpoena and so forth to continue to look into crimes and abuses. This is something that I think should occur regardless of whether or not impeachment should occur, and the congressman agrees. We want impeachment to happen. We want prosecution to happen. But it's also useful to have a truth and reconciliation process to make this a very public process to bring the people into the government over which they are theoretically the sovereigns. It's all very encouraging, but it goes beyond just Congressman Kucinich. And that's what's especially encouraging, is that in these last 2 weeks before Congress goes on vacation for the rest of the year, there are indications of increased interest in impeachment.
On your press release, you cite factors contributing to this new interest in impeachment, and one of them is the risk of what Bush and Cheney might do during the next months in office with Congress on vacation, when it ought to be restoring the rule of law to the nation and the world, you write.
Congressman Kucinich's resolution is H-Res, that's R-E-S, H-Res 1258, which is not always the same as H-R 1258. So if you look it up online, look for HRES 1258, or simply go to afterdowningstreet.org/Bush, and you will find everything you could want to know about it, including new co-sponsors like Jim McDermott. We're seeing this increased level of interest in impeachment among Congress members. Perhaps, you know, it's just fake. It's just plain to constituents when they know it's safe. They know there's no risk of possibly being effective at this point. So they'll sign on in support, and Nancy Pelosi won't punish them in any way. But there's every indication that it may be more than that. And as you said, one reason is that there is this risk that the next 4 months actually exists. You know, they've been telling us since there were 18 months left that, oh, they're almost out the door. And they continue to say they're almost out the door. It's been, I mean, newspaper stories have said the words a few months left in the Bush-Cheney administration since there was a year and a half left, and they're still saying it. But there are 4 months left. They could attack Iran. There are indications that they are still hoping to do so. And they will certainly continue the disastrous policies of the last year and 8 months. It's an enormous, enormous concern, but it's really the secondary concern. The primary need for impeachment arises out of the need to communicate to future presidents and vice presidents, the next ones and the ones 20 years from now, that they have to obey laws. I mean, we are really establishing that they do not. And the Democrats didn't care much about that when they were certain that by ignoring the Constitution, they could get a landslide and put a Democrat in the White House for the next 4 years, in which case, you know, the long-term future of the Republic be damned. But now that they're seeing the polls showing a tight race, which is inexplicable, but a tight race between Obama and McCain, they're starting to worry, now what if we give all of these powers to John McCain without having held Bush and Cheney in check? So that's one of the concerns that I think is finally entering the minds of some Congress members.
Democrats have been now talking about how to put the focus back on John McCain rather than his vice presidential pick, Sarah Palin. How can they do that?
Well, there are a number of ways to do that, right? One is to simply talk about trivial McCain scandals and how many houses he owns and so forth. The other is to look seriously at his record and hold him accountable for it. And I cannot imagine a better way than to hold impeachment hearings, to force an impeachment trial in the Senate, at which Senator Obama would be forced to stand up and defend the Constitution, and at which Senator McCain would be forced to stand up and defend the president and or the vice president and his multiple positions on each of their past crimes. I mean, John McCain doesn't open his mouth anymore without bragging about how he was supposedly tortured. Well, here is a senator who led the fight to ban torture as if it had ever been legal. It was all for show anyway. And then when the president signed with a signing statement and gave himself the right to torture anyway, John McCain kept quiet. And when the president signed a bill to permit himself to torture, John McCain voted for it, spoke out in support of it. If he will flip on this issue, on the issue of torture, on his brand as a torture victim, he is now in support of torturing other people, and they are being tortured, then he'll flip on anything. And he takes away his strongest Hollywood theatrical character personality point of being a torture victim if he is forced to explain how he was against torture before he was for it. And the same with all of the other issues. He has multiple positions on each of them, but his strongest position is always in support of the president and vice president's crimes. And so he would have to maintain that he would not commit these crimes, but he defends the president and the vice president for having committed them. It would be a gold mine for the Democrats. And this goes for the war as well. John McCain would not be a serious contender at all if the Democrats were strongly opposing the incredibly unpopular war that he's constantly bragging about his support for. So demanding impeachment is about something much more long-term than one little election. But it is also the way for the Democrats to go on the offensive and win it. I think there is some understanding growing among more progressive members of Congress that this is about something bigger than one election. And the fact that the election is so close after this strategy they've attempted may be helping to drive that forward despite Nancy Pelosi. You look at just the recent history, and you look at the history back 230 years, the safe thing to electorally when impeachment is called for is to impeach. And when they did it with Nixon, they won big. And when they refused to do it with Reagan exactly as they're doing now, they lost big. And when the Republicans went after Truman, they won. When the Republicans went after Clinton against the overwhelming opinion of the American public, they lost 5 seats. They hung on to the House and the Senate and the White House. And you saw Al Gore running for president, pretending he had never been a friend of Bill Clinton, who was incredibly popular, and picking Joe Lieberman as his running mate, who was not popular at all, because he was put on the defensive by impeachment. So you have to recognize that if we have a President Obama, there will be a Republican push for impeachment immediately. These are people who play offense. The Democrats only play defense, even when offense is called for.
Now, you also discuss an accumulated frustration after 2 years of subpoenas and contempt citations that were ignored. So between that and your other concerns that Bush will attempt to pardon himself, his vice president, and other subordinates for crimes the president himself authorized, I want to ask specifically about one party that has actually had a big influence on the election yet again, despite what we might have expected, and that is Karl Rove. I'm given to understand he's now working for John McCain. Do you know anything about that? Can you comment on Rove and on the style of the campaign that John McCain is running now?
Karl Rove is one of many who have refused to comply with subpoenas. And, of course, the contempt citations, the Justice Department, so-called, has refused to enforce. And Karl Rove has simply claimed a blanket right to refuse to comply with any subpoenas because he used to work for the president. He's not claimed any particular executive privilege, much less a specific executive privilege related to national security. He simply claimed that he doesn't feel inclined to comply with the subpoenas, and he won't. And others, including Condoleezza Rice, have claimed the same thing. In fact, Dick Cheney announced preemptively in 2006 that if he were subpoenaed, he wouldn't comply. This is the tack they have taken. And it's interesting that Sarah Palin out in Alaska with this investigation of her investigation into a trooper who was a brother-in-law in a family feud and so on is asserting the same privilege to refuse to comply with any court subpoenas because she's the governor. And so we know what the attitude of the next administration will be, and in fact of any administration in the future, if this is allowed to stand. And so the question is, what is Congress going to do about it? Because they have spent 2 years very carefully avoiding impeachment, yet putting up this gradual, slow-moving pretense of attempting to do something short of impeachment. Now those subpoenas and contempt citations are going to be ignored through the end of this administration, and it remains to be seen whether Congress will reintroduce all of those subpoenas and contempt citations in the new Congress and the new administration. And if they will not commit publicly to doing that now, it leads to this cynicism that it's all been a pretense. While they avoided impeachment, they didn't intend to do anything at all in the direction of accountability and congressional power as representatives of the people. We need Congress to make that commitment. We need Congress to take a strong position now, in fact, to pass legislation, even if it will be vetoed, banning the pardoning of a president by himself and banning the pardoning by a president for crimes that he himself authorized his subordinates to commit. This is absolutely absurd, and yet it's on the radar screen. There's discussion that it may happen, and if Congress does not preemptively take an opinion that it's unconstitutional, they certainly won't do so afterward. So we need all of those things to happen. Karl Rove, I see him as the embodiment of most of what's wrong with this administration, along with Dick Cheney. He has pushed the envelope constantly of lawlessness. And, he's been running a Republican political operation out of the White House while he was employed there in violation of the Hatch Act, using our public dollars to fund a political operation that's gone beyond anything previously imagined. It's turned the Justice Department into a branch of the Republican Party. And he has clearly been, in recent elections and the upcoming election, a lead player in efforts to strip Democratic voters from the voting rolls, to suppress voter turnout, to manipulate electronic voting machine counts, as well as to hammer the opponents in the elections through attacks in the media. And he's had a tremendous influence, and he clearly is still very much involved.
You know, I watched David Gergen last night discuss the idea that, you know, now Barack Obama feels like Hillary Clinton felt. He thought he had the election, you know, had the nomination and was confident, and then along comes Sarah Palin and threw him off, and now he's defensive. And my immediate reaction to it, actually, as a reporter, was to talk about how amazingly wrong the coverage is. It's still he said, she said. It's still all this bizarre personality analysis, when what the American people really need as voters is the facts about policies. Why don't you comment finally on the press?
There's virtually no coverage of policy positions, and part of that can be blamed on the fact that there are such slight differences between the two parties. But there are differences, and they should be talked about, and they aren't. The vast majority of coverage is of the candidates' television advertisements, of their financial reports, of their polling positions, and of nonsense personality scandals, and the race and gender and other characteristics of the candidates, which are not without importance, but not an importance that should completely eliminate coverage of policy positions. On top of which, we don't have investigative reporting, and we have very limited fact-checking, so that we have our airwaves used to broadcast the speeches and the conventions, and at enormous expense to all of us in multiple ways, the television advertisements of these candidates, and very limited communications of the fact that very often they're lying. The Associated Press did an article on a small number of Sarah Palin's lies during her convention speech, but not nearly all of them, and very few newspapers ran that article. Most of them, if anything, ran the AP story on who said what at the convention without commentary, without critical analysis, and that's the norm, of course, and especially on television, where most people get their so-called news.
Diebold, the company with the new name that won't stick, has admitted that its GEM software, its optical scan and DRE touchscreen machines both can drop votes and are flawed. What about coverage of the election systems in general and the voting machines in particular?
Well, this has been a huge problem that's grown dramatically worse each election, and the coverage of it has grown less and less. The media is intent on not covering the problem, which is a disaster for our country. We know what the solution is. We need to ban private corporations from having anything to do with counting our votes. We need to be able to count our votes credibly, verifiably, locally at each polling place. And that requires paper ballots, and that requires hand counting them with a variety of observers and an ability to recount them with those totals announced locally at each polling place. There's no other solution, and yet we are going to have the majority of the public voting yet again, either on DRE, touchscreen and roulette machines, or on paper ballots that are counted by unreliable machines in many places where you cannot even demand a recount if you want to. And we're looking at a very, very questionable election. And if it is close, it will not be believable to many voters on either side, no matter which candidate wins. This is the heart of our democracy, and nobody's doing anything about it. Many individuals, many citizens are doing things about it. There are lawsuits being pursued in Ohio now about the 2004 elections. And the New York Times did finally, these many years later, run a column by Adam Cohen a few weeks ago admitting that there have been at least a handful of elections in recent years where we have no idea, we have no way of knowing who really won. He's pretty sure that probably the right guy won, but we should fix things for the future. This is what we get out of the U.S. media, is that our electoral system has all sorts of problems that might result in bad elections in the future, but never have in the past. I hope it doesn't take a disaster this year to break out of that mold. I hope we can break out of it in the coming weeks.
David Swanson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joy.
Just an update to this interview. We've just heard from the Anchorage Daily News that Governor Sarah Palin's husband, Todd Palin, has been subpoenaed in the firing of a state police officer in Alaska. David Swanson of Democrats.com. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program was produced in the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.